come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept that that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your tattoo you is worth saving, ah, then you better start swimming, or you sing like a stone. Oh, the times they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. Ah, the loser now will be later the winner. Oh, the times they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please hear the call. And don't stand in the doorway, don't block out the hall. Oh, for he who gets hurt will be he who has stalled now. And they battle outside and it's raging. Oh, we'll soon shake your windows and rattle. Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and now don't criticize who you don't understand, cause your sons and your daughters have yawned your command. And the old road is rapidly aging, oh, so get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times they are a-changing. The light it is drawn and the curse it has cast, and the slow one now, he will later be fast. That's the present now, will later be past. Well, the order is rapidly fading. Oh, and the first one now, he will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
Okay, it's not Andrea Bocelli, I know. But it's interesting when you get a song that so shaped a cultural revolution of the 1960s, with Bob Dylan singing, "The Times They're A-Changing," in a busy Dublin street, no one is paying attention to what was a revolutionary song, a cry that the times, they really are changing. And I thought the imagery of that song was awesome because people are just walking by like nothing's going on. Now, I need to, before going on, just give a couple of disclaimers. First of all, I understand that having emailed you all a document this week, that it's impossible for me not to be preaching something on that. But I've got to say, if we were talking on Job, I couldn't say anything about it. But if God gives me the passages, and that's just part of the sermon prep that was organized 6 months ago, I've got to do it. So please bear with me. It's not that I'm trying to push it. It's just the scriptures are there. Another thing I also need to disclaim, and it's an apology. I normally put quite a lot of time into my sermon prep. This morning's sermon was written this morning. So now you'll get the difference between a really well-prepped sermon and something that Rob really had to just kind of quickly throw together. And if there's no difference, I'll be disappointed. Okay? So come up to you afterwards and say, Rob, you could have done better, and I'll be happy. And by the way, there's a bell up here somewhere. What's this bell called? Oh, the heresy bell. Look at that. It's even written on it. Tell you what, once you've got a master's in biblical studies, you can ring this. I'm kidding. Oh, the good old Pentecostal response. I don't need any training. The great thing about what Zach does and with his little group is that the challenge is always open. Okay? And that's something that I want to challenge all of us. Richard will sit there, and if he doesn't agree with it, the bell rings. I don't want you to do that while I'm preaching. Wait till afterwards. But the challenge is there. You don't take what I say as gospel. Your challenge is to measure that from what you know in Scripture. And then if you feel you need to challenge it, challenge it. Challenge it. So I think it's actually a pretty cool idea. And I'm glad that one of our leaders feels comfortable to sit with a group of people and allow them to challenge him when they're talking on stuff like this. So let's get into it, huh? Okay, so this song that came up, as opposed to last week, we were looking at Matthew chapter 8. Those verses in that chapter were emotional. So when you listen to someone like Andrea Bocelli, you have no idea what he's saying because it's all in Italian. And unless you're Italian, you don't know the story, right? You're just like, whoa, that sounds so cool. And you're taken by the emotion and all. This time around, it's a little bit more intimate. The words mean something. Listen to the words of this song. Come gather around people wherever you roam and admit that the waters around you have grown and accept that it's soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times, they are a-changing. In the last line, last verse, he says this, the time it is drawn, the curse it is cast, the slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past, the order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times, they are a-changing. They're powerful lyrics. They're quite a challenge. So if we saw last week in chapter 8 being a symphony, an emotional, crescendo that we get caught up in, this week we're looking at more of a ballad where Jesus has got some really important words that require listening to. I was talking with Mark Boyce the other day, and he was telling me, because I'd sent this email that was rather long out to people. I got quite a lot of responses, but I realized in some of those responses that the people really didn't read through the whole thing because they were asking questions that were in the document. Now, let me just say, the document you received, the elders and the staff got an 8-page document. So those poor fellas had to read through 8 pages of all that stuff. But he had this really neat idea that he does with his, when he's doing training and stuff. He'll write at the beginning, he told me, he says, I'll write down, this is really important that you read this word for word. And then when he gets to the last sentence, he's got this little disclaimer. He says, if you've read this far, email me and I'll give you a chocolate fish. And he says, usually out of a group of 20, I get about 3 emails saying, I want my chocolate fish. But it's important in this sense that Jesus' words are listened to. So the ballad here isn't the emotion of the music and all that it encases, it's the lyrics. And the lyrics need paying attention to. They really do need just a moment to just sit and let them sink in. With me? We're in the middle of Matthew chapter 10, and Jesus does an incredible thing here. It's subtle, It can get, especially for those of us who are not Jewish, who have not grown up in that kind of environment, we could just like ride right over it and not understand the implications of what Jesus is saying in chapter 10. But a few years ago, when I first arrived to New Zealand, we came to a Apawa Baptist Church, and the first big task I was given when I arrived wasn't the earthquake that happened 2 months afterwards. It was our centenary. The church was celebrating its centenary. And in that November, we were going to have this big party, this big celebration, this big talk. And we had all this whole weekend working out, and we're working through that. And it was all about 100 years of Apawa Baptist Church, which for any church in New Zealand is not a bad thing to celebrate, being around 100 years, especially in our day and age where a lot of churches are being sold or closed. So it was an awesome event, and we did these fantastic, their old A-frame, which is this incredibly progressive, creative building that they built in the 1950s, we decked it all out, and we had this big dinner, and at this dinner, all these people came, and they talked about all these incredibly powerful things that the church had done in the past. Some things are absolutely crazy, you know, and we're listening to all these stories. One of our oldest pastors, who was still alive, 93, he's up in Auckland now, he came down and shared about the years of work and what they had done and how they carried the organ from the church to Lancaster Park when Billy Graham came, because Billy Graham used a Apawa Baptist Church's organ, you know, and it was just all these stories that they did. I mean, it wasn't a far walk from the church to Lancaster Park, but that organ's heavy. That was a miracle they got it down there. And I can imagine the organist just biting his nails. Is it in tune? Is it still there? You know, and it's just all these incredible stories that they did so out of the box. Then I get up to talk and I'm like, why are we listening to these stories? And there was dead silence. I said, we're sitting in a building, people, that the church split over. That when the leadership said, we're going to make this decision to build this church, 1951, people were like, that's not a church. That's a ski chalet. And they split over it. It caused all sorts of dramas. It was really interesting because by the time I began pastoring this church, this building had an earthquake rating of 5%. But the church did not want to pull it down. That's our church. And in 1951, they were splitting over it. And I said to them, I said, we do honor those who have come before us. We do honor those who have done all this great stuff. But the challenge for us is they stepped out of the box. And we honor them by not doing anything at all, but living off what they did. And so the challenge I laid at Apawa was, we remember the past because they were innovators, they were risk takers, they stepped out, they did things that back in those days was crazy. Today, we sit exactly where we are because we don't want to be crazy. And there's the challenge. It actually went down well. Fortunately, it was only 3 months or 4 months into my first senior pastor at Apawa. But that was a challenge. And Jesus, in the middle of chapter 10, in the middle of this talk on mission, at the end of chapter 10, he'll conclude his talk on what mission's about. But in the middle of all this, he begins to challenge people by establishing a new way of being God's people. It's a huge challenge. Now, I had all these thoughts about, you know, the whole Israel Folau incident that's going on in Australia. It's big here. You know, how, because chapter 10 talks right into that. You want to read a good response to how do we handle something like that? Read chapter 10, verses 1 to 10. And that will tell you how you respond, because when Jesus sends out people, he sends them not to go out to condemn people, not to tell them that they're going to hell, not to tell them what they're doing wrong. You go out and heal people. you go out and meet them where they're at. I was going to go right into that, but then I thought, I want to talk about us. Because I frankly feel that we as a people of God, people think we could do this better, sure, but I think we do a good job of wanting to heal people around us. I really think we do. There's challenges there, don't get me wrong. And that's not meaning I'm going to let you off easily on that. I will challenge you more on that. And there's far more growing that we can do. But I want to challenge you of what it means to be God's people. Because in the middle of all of this, Jesus says these extraordinary words that get completely lost in the whole sense of evangelism and mission. Because they don't form part of Evangelism 101. It's these words. I've got Matthew 8, but it's actually Matthew 10, verses 11 to 12. Do not suppose that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Now, when we think of Christmas, what do the angels say to the shepherds? Yes, peace on earth, peace to all mankind. What's another name for Jesus? The Prince of what? So why is he saying this? Is he contradicting himself? What's going on here? He's telling you that the way of evangelism is going to divide people. The peace that he brings is between humans and God. The peace that he brings is that reconciliation that we have through him between us and God the Father. Where he's challenging us here is, now remember, this is a ballad. He's talking to the disciples. He's not on the Sermon on the Mount. He's not preaching it to the masses. He's preaching it to a small group of people. Think of it as a breakout session at a conference or whatever. There's just a small group of them, and he's hitting them hard with this because these are the people he wants to send out. But he's telling them, hey, you're not here to bring peace. Because you know what's going to happen? The moment you step out in my name, there will be no peace. People will stand against you. And then he goes on to say these incredibly harsh words. For I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. And then furthermore, anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Ouch! Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is what? Not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is what? Say it out loud. It's those last words that you imagine just sitting in this little conference, 12 of you here just sitting there and you're listening, you're getting the pep talk about mission. And then he says these things. You're like, the wife's not going to like this. What do I tell her when I get home? But the difference here is that a lot of this just goes over our head. For Peter and for Andrew and for John and James and Bartholomew and a lot of them, they're listening to this and they know exactly where he's coming from because he's quoting from Micah chapter 7 here. But still, it's shocking. I'll break that down a little bit later on. It's shocking because it's a hard word. Evangelism is just going out and sharing the word, closing the sale, signing the contract, dunking them underwater and adding them to the membership. Make sure they tithe because we need the money. We've kind of simplified it to that, right? I'm making fun of it, but it's far deeper than that. We're not talking about the world out there. He's talking to us directly. He says, you've got to realize the challenge that you face going out in my name. You've got to realize what this is going to cost you. And if you're not prepared to take that cost, well, you're not worthy of me. Is it a wonder that this is the small crowd, when he takes this word to the bigger crowd, the whole lot of them abandon him. A whole lot of them just walk away. They're like, yeah, okay, Jesus. Good on you, mate. Down to the pub, man. I've had enough of this. And he's left alone. He has got to turn back to these 12. And he says, are you guys still with me? And their response is, where else can we go? All we have is you. In the middle of Matthew 10, in the middle of mission, Jesus establishes a new way of being God's people. And this won't sit well for some. And bear with me, I'm not intending to tie what I've sent out this week to this. It just happens to be that. If I didn't have that email out this week and all the work that's been put into that, I'd still be preaching something along these lines. So bear with me. Don't feel guilty. I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. But this is the truth of it. When a power wanted to build a church that would be a landmark in Christchurch, their argument was, well, the Anglicans have got the cathedral, the Catholics have got the cathedral, we're in the middle of Southeast Christchurch. There's nothing here that people look to and say, there's church. Let's do something completely crazy. Let's do something completely out of the box. We want to honor God. We want to be God's people. And this is a new way that he's calling us to do this. And they did it. And they lost a good chunk of people over it. But here's the thing. The first Sunday that service started with the new building, the police had to block the road off. There are photos of people spilling out way up onto Brougham Street trying to get in. They had a massive problem. They built that building because they'd outgrown the little hall next door to it. In one service, they outgrew that one building. There was all these people outside trying to get in. But this won't sit well for some. It won't sit well for some when we're called to do something that's a bit out of control. Like evangelism. Because it's uncomfortable. And because the way we've made evangelism, it is uncomfortable unless you're a salesman. And if you're a salesman, it's right up your alley. But most of us are not salesmen here. My brother-in-law, God bless him, instrumental in bringing both my wife and I to Christ. God used him in a powerful way. But he had everything going for him. He was a used car salesman. He was a sergeant in the Marines. You couldn't say no to him. Right? This won't sit well for some. And what Jesus is saying, this is not about you. It's about me. It's about Jesus. And of course it's going to be uncomfortable for you because it's actually not about you. It's about you getting out of your own comfort zone. It's about you actually stepping out and saying, what's most important in my life? It's Jesus, not me. We've got all sorts of ways to combat uncomfortableness when it comes to evangelism, when it comes to being called to do something a little different. You know, things like it's not the way we've done it. Churches are experts at this, by the way. We've got all sorts of responses to things that just kind of push us out of our comfort zone. Things that challenge us, you know, when we ask to give more, or when we ask, you know, when was the last time you shared your faith with someone? You know, or when was the last time, you know, you brought and dropped a meal over someone's place, gave them a hug, prayed for them? When was the last time you stopped and maybe spent a good half an hour looking at the Word of God and just reflecting on who God is? And we've got all these responses to it. But the biggest challenge we're faced with is that we don't do it that way. We don't act that way. So we respond that way. I don't do it that way. We've not done it this way as a church. Rob, what are you saying? This is the way we've always done it. Who are you to change things? It's a response that when we're challenged to step out of our comfort zones, it doesn't seem right. There's this ethereal thing in our heads that tell us immediately, I'm just not comfortable with that. Why can't that be a positive thing? Why is that a negative thing? Why, if I'm driven to do something different, something that makes me feel uncomfortable, is the response, well, it doesn't seem right? Actually, it might seem right because you are uncomfortable. Because it very much doesn't feel right that makes it right. We always tend to go the comfort side. It's not logical. Those of us who are a little bit more up here, who've got the strength of being able to kind of measure the box and make it right, our response can be, well, it's not logical. It doesn't make sense. What sense does it make that God had to send Jesus Christ on earth to die for us? Why couldn't he just snap his fingers and make it right? There's a lot of things that don't make sense. And sometimes logic is not going to be able to answer that for you. And the great one that some of us who don't like conflict, everyone's not on board. We want everyone to be on board. And Jesus is telling us, you know, when you follow me and you put me first, not everyone's going to follow. You can strive for unity, but at the end of the day, that's not what drives us. When Jesus quotes Micah, Israel are in a very peculiar situation. In a very peculiar situation. They have chosen not to be saved, and Micah's challenging them that you need to understand that God is starting. He's going to put in place a new way. And for you to be rescued, this is what needs to happen. N.T. Wright, in his commentary on Micah in that verse, says this. He says, when God acts to save his people, there are always some who declare that they don't need rescuing. It's not because they don't want to be rescued. It's because they're comfortable where they are. And so they will push back on that. And Jesus is saying, hey, you know what? You might like me, but I'm not calling to your life of comfort. I'm not calling you to a place where you can just be yourselves. Evangelism is not about how I want to do it or what makes me feel comfortable. Sharing my faith is not about waiting for the perfect moment. Stepping out in faith is not when the odds are that this will work. Stepping out in faith is, actually, I really don't know if this is right or not. The whole basis of faith. I trust that it is. So I'm going to give you some pointers out of these passages just to help us. How do we deal with such a hard comment from Jesus in our own personal lives when we're called to share his gospel, to be the light of the world to this world, to be challenged as a community of God's people? How can we do this? The first thing I want to share with you is that we need to get in the habit of maximizing Jesus into our lives. I was thinking of James Webber this week, and I was just thinking of some stuff that we had talked about in the past, and it popped in my mind this morning, and I was thinking about it because I was in front of the computer, and I hit the play button on the PowerPoint, and it just takes over the whole screen, right? And I was like, oh, that's what we've got to do with Jesus, right? You know, we've got to maximize him. He's got to fill our screens, right? That doesn't mean we don't have other things going on in the background, right? There's always going to be things happening there, right? And that's okay. And sometimes we might need to switch out in the end, and we, you know, control alt and Mac guy going around from screen to screen. But you know what? He has to fill the screen. We need to maximize him in our lives, not anything else. That doesn't preclude everything else. It just means he's bigger than everything else. He has to be. We did a wedding yesterday, and it was awesome. Wonderful time. Stefan and Abby getting married, and you know the love story and all of that. And as I'm sitting there telling, giving them the sermon that most couples will always forget, because by about 10:30 that night, what did Rob say? Did Rob say something in the No. The kiss happens. That's it. Everything before that's forgotten completely. It's like childbirth. You know, forget about all the pain, and they go for another kid. Oh, I'm kidding. Come on. So I'm sitting there. I'm sharing this with them, and I tried to add some humor to it. I don't know if it worked or not, but I kept going. I was trying to, and you know, the biggest thing for me was, you know, that verse in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. The three-corded strand can never break. It's so powerful. Just out of nowhere, if you read verse 12, he's talking about two are better than one. You know, if they go to work together, you know, two better work better than one. You know, when they lie in bed, two can keep themselves warm. All this stuff. And then all of a sudden, he said a three-braided cord is impossible to break. And you think, where did that come from? That's bringing Christ into the center. That he is the thing that keeps us. He is the maximized screen in our lives. Everything else pours from that. Our marriages, our relationships, our kids, our jobs, our houses, how we do things, ministry, everything is minimized to Jesus' maximized presence in our lives because everything flows from that. Verse in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 to 2. And let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus. We maximize Jesus into our lives. So that's point one, maximize Jesus. Point two is this, minimize self. I'm doing a teaching in September at Arrow on developing personal vision. And it's been minimized on my screen now for about 2 months. And it will stay there for another month and a half. Right? I've got to do that with myself sometimes. I cannot get to it because there's just a lot of other work going on. But actually, it needs to be intentional. It's not the right time. When it comes to us, we need to actually minimize ourselves. So when it comes to thinking, what do I think? If we're maximizing Jesus, well, what does Jesus think? I'm curious to know what I think, but how's that compare to what Jesus would think? It's interesting because we tend to manipulate that and start thinking, well, Jesus would think this way, right? I do it frequently. Am I the only one that does it? Minimize self. Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, I've been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. Christ lives in me. Three quick things on the basis of that. First thing, spiritual perception. Everything is spiritual. We have to grasp that. Everything is spiritual. Right? Everything we do is spiritual. We are spiritual beings. And everything has a consequence spiritually. But we tend to manipulate that spirituality. And the challenge I want for you this morning is as you try to minimize yourself, challenge your own spiritual perceptions. I'm going to use this week as an example of that. I've had several people tell me, Rob, that's not enough money for the disruption we're going to have to go through. And my response to them is to say, it's not the money that I'm worried about, but is the disruption something God wants us to go through? Think of it that way. Because if it is what God wants us to do, to be disrupted, then it doesn't matter about the money. Doesn't mean I'm not going to negotiate a better amount. Still have to care for us. But that's not the driving point. The driving point is, are we being disrupted? And is that what God wants? Usually we say we're being disrupted, so if you give me more money, then it's okay to be disrupted. But that's not the point, right? Have I got a point? It's not the money that's going to do, it's actually the disruption. If the disruption is what God is calling us to do, I would do it for half the amount. Or actually, if I'm really following God, I'll do it for free. Yeah, these guys get it. If that's what God is calling us to do, it doesn't matter all the perks we get from it. And that's the challenge we've got. spiritual perception. Let me also challenge you on the other end of that spectrum. Oh, Rob, movies, you know, spiritually, I'm not sure we should be doing those in a sanctified place like the church. What's that going to impact our kids and all that? It was really interesting because I had that comment while I was sitting with someone in the middle of Hot Gossip and Eminem was playing on her radio. And I'm listening to 8 Mile on one side and this person talking to me about, you know, the spiritual implications of these movies. And I'm like, if there is one thing Bob Dylan taught us back in the 60s, is that music has far more of an influence on our children than any movie out there. So if you really want to be consistent in your spiritual perceptions, don't worry about the movies, worry about what they're playing in Hot Gossip. Because our kids know that far better than a movie. And so there's that spiritual perception balance. You know, we've just got to be challenged sometimes. And that's where Jesus comes in. He says, maximize me and minimize yourself. Maximize me, minimize yourself. What would I do? What have I called you to do? What's the challenge here? Where are the issues? If we're getting disrupted just for disruption's sake, that's wrong. If we're doing it just for the money, I'd say that's wrong too. We're doing it because either God's calling us to do it or God's not calling us to do it. That's really the basis of it. And that's this last word I want to share with you out of this, how do I minimize myself? And that's seeking. We've got to be a people that seeks God. One thing that actually hurts for us is that when we pray on a Sunday, but when outside of that, do we all get together and just pray? When do we do that together? We've tried with Whakaronga Mai. We tried getting people to pray for our city down by the river there. I think we averaged, what, 4 or 5 people, 6 people? We've got to be seeking God. That's got to be the heart of who we are. As a people together, don't leave it to Rob or all those crazy youth who are spending all that time praying. Should be out playing. What's up with that? Watching movies. What are they going out praying? You know, we've got to do that as a people. We've got to be seeking God. That actually then begins to minimize us and maximize Him. Right? We've got to be seeking God together. Even if praying sometimes is boring. Believe me, I'm part of many prayer groups, and sometimes I'm sitting there going, so much work to do. This person's waffling. They've said it 5 times now. Come on, God's heard you the first time. I know it. I know how it feels because I'm there. But out of obedience, God's called me to be there, and I want to be there. We've got to be seeking God. Minimize ourselves. We've got to challenge our spiritual perceptions. We've got to be challenged by our selfishness. I didn't talk about that, did I? I skipped it. Sorry. That's what happens when you write a sermon just a couple of hours ago. Selfishness. Selfishness is an important part of what society has told us to do. Is that you've got to, you know, you've got to get a job, you've got to do this, and you've got to do this, and you've got to. It's really interesting with parents when I'm talking about couples, their children getting married. Oh, Rob, wait till they finish uni, and then they can get married once they've got a job. And I'm like, you're denying them a journey of difficulty, by the way, which will actually bond their marriage closer. Even if they're at uni, let them get married. Then they journey those steps together, those difficult steps actually bond people. But in our selfishness, we want to make everything right before they can get it wrong. I don't know. It's just an example, but we've got to be careful what society pushes on us. And a lot of that is selfishness. It's a very selfish culture. Let's not buy into that. Minimize yourself through spiritual perceptions, through minimizing our selfishness and seeking God together. And lastly, I think I've gone over in time, but is revitalized service. You want to maximize Jesus and minimize self? Start serving. Don't sit there and say they do this wrong or they don't do this right and they should be doing this and they should be doing that. The moment you just start selflessly serving, you'll find the natural outcome of that is Jesus will become more maximized and you'll become more minimized. And even if they might not agree with what you're doing, I personally don't care. If you're serving, all power to you. Don't worry what others are thinking. Romans 12:1 says, therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Give everything up for me. Be not just who you are, but everything you are for me, and you will see Christ maximize, you minimize, and you will find life. And that may mean not being able to agree with your children or with your spouses or with your friends. They might be standing against you. Your own household might be an enemy. But it's maximizing Jesus, minimizing yourself. And if you're prepared to die for me, says Jesus, then you are worthy of me. I have been a youth pastor for 10 years. There is one thing I'm glad I don't have to do anymore, and that's camps. Maximize Jesus, minimize yourself. No, all power to you guys. I remember we in the States it's different than here. In the summertime, here everything shuts down. In the US, parents are still working, and we've got a whole bunch of kids that need to have some sort of something happening for them. So it's actually our busiest time from June through to August, and we don't have one camp. We have about four or five camps, all big camps with all big things going, and all these kids raising money all year. I mean, it was a whole year of fundraising, it felt like, to do four or five camps. And the way they had these camps set up, it was in the middle of nowhere, usually West Virginia. The gnats were everywhere. Mozzies were everywhere. And I'd be in a room with about 20 other, 13 to 15-year-old boys in all bunk beds. And after about two or three days, the smell in there was unbearable. It was fun. But as you get older, you're like, another camp coming up. I'm done, It was the power in what our youth leaders do in trying in their way of maximizing Jesus and minimizing themselves means giving up a whole weekend of sleep, of walking alongside young people, of holding, praying, crying. There's a microcosm there of maximizing Jesus, minimizing self, and absolute energized service. And it should challenge us as the wider church. What can we do that goes beyond just a weekend of that? What can we do that actually makes it happen every day? Maybe not to the extent of Easter camp, because that is a lot of work. Zach almost passed out, right there. Actually, I do want to call up our youth pastors because I want to pray over them, and I want to have them call up their leaders, and we'll get the youth up here as well and pray over them, because part of what we're going to do is seek God together as God's community. I've challenged you this morning. So you're going to tell me afterwards that I wish you had a few more days to make it a little bit more coherent, right? Okay, no one laughed. Okay. Sorry. The challenge is, how can we be more with Jesus on that big front screen? And how can we become a little bit more perceptive spiritually, less selfish? What was the last one? Seek God together as God's community. We're sending off a whole bunch of people. We're putting these guys into action. They have been in action for the last month or two now. We're going to pray over them. Was the process then to bring the kids up?
Yeah. I just first of all want to